I'm Jill Dittmeier, and this is Curious Mix. Listen in as we meet the people and explore the places and programs celebrating the arts and culture in our communities. Keep your ears open for these sounds and the stories behind them. This year marks the 50th anniversary of the speech that then New York Senator Robert Kennedy gave in Indianapolis on the night that Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated. In April of 1968, Kennedy was running for the Democratic nomination for president. On the night of April 4th, he was flying to Indianapolis to make a campaign speech in a working-class black neighborhood on the city's near north side. When he arrived, he learned that King had been shot and killed, and that reaction was causing riots in many of the cities across the country. Local police warned that they couldn't offer protection, but Kennedy wasn't deterred. He scrapped his campaign speech and instead talked sincerely to the people gathered at 17th and Broadway.
Do they know about Martin Luther King?
Indianapolis residents Teresa Lovers, Billy Bro, and Jim Trulock were there in the park at 17th and Broadway on that April night. The four of us sat down to talk about what it felt like to hear Kennedy's words then and what those words mean to them now.
I was 16. I was a junior at Warren Central High School.
That's Teresa Lovers. She's the current Indiana Commissioner for Higher Education and a former state senator.
And I had been at a junior achievement meeting, and my brother picked me up, and we decided to stop and at the event, not knowing that Dr. King had been shot.
Could you lower those signs, please? I have some very sad news for all of you, and that is that Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis.
What has stayed with me in such a poignant way is the impact of his communication skills and his ability to connect with an audience in a very genuine way by reflecting on his own personal experience. No one ever questioned the strength of his words or the power of his words, because he managed to connect with that audience in just an unbelievably real way.
For those of you who are black and are tempted to be filled with hatred and mistrust of the injustice of such an act against all white people, I would only say that I can also feel in my own heart the same kind of feeling. I had a member of my family killed, but he was killed by a white man.
And do you remember the conversations you had with your friends then?
It was 1968. It was such an interesting, powerful, change, a year that changed so many things. And so I think it was, we had those discussions, not with the full understanding of what was going on, but the understanding that you could have as a junior in high school. This was, right after Dick Lugar had become mayor of Indianapolis, and I have had a long, four-decade relationship with Lugar, so I've often heard him talk about his visits to church basements, to meet with community organizations, because it wasn't just that night. I mean, it was the impact of that night and just dashed dreams for so many people who had placed their hopes and their dreams on the message of Dr. King, and so I think it had a continuing impact on the city.
What we need in the United States is not hatred. What we need in the United States is not violence and lawlessness, but is love and wisdom and compassion toward one another.
And I was down at his campaign headquarters and drove up to 17th Street for the rally.
Billy Bro is now a retired teacher and a former Indiana State Senator. But in 1968, she was in her late 20s, teaching school at IPS and working as a volunteer for Kennedy's campaign.
Well, the first thing that I recall is the weather. It was one of those dreary, wet, cold, ugly-looking evenings, okay? And while driving in the car, my husband drove me because at that time I didn't drive very well. And I did hear that Martin Luther King had been shot, but that was all I heard. I didn't hear anything else. So I was in anticipation. I didn't know what to believe.
And when you got there and Mr. Kennedy was there, did time just kind of stand still for you?
Absolutely. I remember him on this truck, surrounded by, looked like mostly men at the time. And the crowd just seemed to be hanging on. And I was very anxious to hear what he had to say.
Martin Luther King dedicated his life to love and to justice between fellow human beings. He died in the cause of that effort.
Did he say what you thought he would say?
No. Yes and no. He was the calm, interesting person that I had read about, right? I could not believe, again, that his soul seemed to be so with the people in that park, in that area, that he would speak to us as individuals and human beings and not as ghetto and black. I cannot think of another person who would have been in that situation and quoted poetry to us. But it was the right thing to do, and I think it's the thing that oftentimes we overlook and forget. We think that because we are poor, we don't know anything and we don't appreciate anything. And it's just the opposite.
My favorite poet was Aeschylus. He once wrote, "Even in our sleep, pain which cannot forget falls drop by drop upon the heart, until in our own despair, against our will, comes wisdom through the awful grace of God."
My name's Jim Trulock. I'm a retired auto worker. I wound up in the last years of being an auto worker as one of their representatives in the Indiana State Legislature, lobbying for what we broadly termed social justice issues.
What made you go to 17th Street that night?
Just to hear a campaign speech in what was, for the Democratic Party, the best ward in the state of Indiana. They produced more Democratic votes than any ward in the state, and that's what he was doing there. He was trying to get people to come and vote for him. I went across the street there and to the place where he was speaking on the back of a flatbed truck, and waited for him, along with, by that time, literally hundreds of others, mostly African-American people, but there were a few white people there, too. And we were waiting on him to show up. He did. And when he came, I think one of the first things he said was, "Put the campaign signs down. I have something to say," which he did. And related his own experiences and his own philosophies to people who had just lost their spiritual leader. I've never heard anything like it. I know I'm not altogether objective about it, but it is the best speech I have ever heard. It lasted maybe 3 minutes tops.
"Could you lower those signs, please? I have some very sad news for all of you, and that is that Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis." Martin Luther King dedicated his life to love and to justice between fellow human beings. He died in the cause of that effort. In this difficult day, in this difficult time for the United States, it's perhaps well to ask what kind of a nation we are. and what direction we want to move in. For those of you who are black, considering the evidence evidently is that there were white people who were responsible, you can be filled with bitterness and with hatred and a desire for revenge. We can move in that direction as a country in greater polarization, black people amongst blacks and white amongst whites, filled with hatred toward one another. Or we can make an effort, as Martin Luther King did, to understand and to comprehend and replace that violence, that stain of bloodshed that is spread across our land, with an effort to understand compassion and love. For those of you who are black and are tempted to be filled with hatred and mistrust of the injustice of such an act against all white people, I would only say that I can also feel in my own heart the same kind of feeling. I had a member of my family killed, but he was killed by a white man. But we have to make an effort in the United States. We have to make an effort to understand, to get beyond or go beyond these rather difficult times. My favorite poem, my favorite poet was Aeschylus. He once wrote, "Even in our sleep, pain which cannot forget falls drop by drop upon the heart, until in our own despair, against our will, comes wisdom through the awful grace of God." What we need in the United States is not division. What we need in the United States is not hatred. What we need in the United States is not violence and lawlessness, but is love and wisdom and compassion toward one another, feeling of justice toward those who still suffer within our country, whether they be white or whether they be black. We can do well in this country. We will have difficult times. We've had difficult times in the past, but we will have difficult times in the future. It is not the end of violence. It is not the end of lawlessness, and it's not the end of disorder. But the vast majority of white people and the vast majority of black people in this country want to live together, want to improve the quality of our life, and want justice for all human beings that abide in our land. Dedicate ourselves to what the Greeks wrote so many years ago, to tame the savageness of man and make gentle the life of this world. Let us dedicate ourselves to that and say a prayer for our country and for our people. Thank you very much.
Have there been experiences in your life since that night that something occurred in your life that was troubling, upsetting, worrisome, or just incredibly overwhelming that you drew back on those words and could kind of hear Robert Kennedy in your head again?
Well, yes, I could. And this actually is very personal. I lost a son some years ago to drug addiction, and I was getting that feeling that some people get in those moments, why me, why us, why him? And I thought, just once again, those words from Aeschylus that Robert Kennedy quoted that night, in these moments of despair, we can find in our own hearts the beginning of peace again.
Do you see anyone now locally, nationally, or up and coming that has that same ability to connect, like Robert Kennedy did, to capture the moment and let down the guard and really connect, to really try to make a change.
I take encouragement from the women's movement that we see taking place today, that all of a sudden we realize, as Jim has said, that we're all in the same boat now, and that this is not the time to let one person or one philosophy overtake the views of the many.
I would talk about it through the lens of the younger generation and the fact that they have, in a very similar way to the late 60s and early 70s, a sense that they want to make a difference and that they're looking for meaning in what they do beyond the amount of money that they make in a job, and which is not to say that, you know, having the opportunity to have a meaningful career isn't certainly important to people. But I think they're looking for other ways to contribute to their communities, and they're not always looking at traditional political or governmental ways to do that. They're looking at communities. They're looking at their engagement with people, and I think that's encouraging.
Teresa, Billy, and Jim will be sharing more of their memories during a storytelling arts presentation this month at the Indie Fringe Theater in downtown Indianapolis. It's sponsored by the Kennedy King Memorial Initiative. This organization promotes and preserves the Martin Luther King Park at 17th and Broadway and also takes care of the large steel sculpture that's there on the site. It's made from two curving pieces of metal, one with a half figure of Kennedy, the other of King, both reaching their hands out to the other. The group has also commissioned a new musical about the speech, and like the storytelling arts presentation, it will also take place at the Indie Fringe Theater. It's called Dear Bobby. Ball State University professor Angela Jackson Brown wrote the production.
The IRT a couple of years ago did a play about that night and that event, and so I knew because they had done such an exceptional job of telling a portion of that story, I felt like if I were going to take this on, I would want to do something that was vastly different from what had already been put out into the atmosphere. So I just finished writing a musical with a colleague of mine, Peter Davis. And so I felt comfortable enough in that space to try to tackle it. And so then I got the idea of these two girls, and I'm hearing their voices, and it just all just started to take shape.
The 12-year-old girls come from opposite sides of Indianapolis. One is Jewish, the other African-American. The play explores the struggles and successes that both communities experience as the city tries to unite during this specific moment in history. Deborah Asante of Asante Children's Theater is directing.
Has been very interesting, but I love that it is a study of contrast. There's information, and I tease the kids all the time. I know everything, and as I read, there were things I didn't know. So, and then the contrast of the two cultures, the admiration. Both girls admire the man, but in different ways.
13-year-old Amani Mohammed plays one of the girls.
I portray Annabelle. She is a 12-year-old girl who's in an African-American family, and she is a huge fan of Bobby Kennedy. She reads all his books. She watches all of his speeches. She listens to him on the radio. She knows everything about him.
But Amani knew nothing about Bobby Kennedy.
I've been watching documentaries. I've been looking up articles, you know, just movies, shows, stuff like that.
Neither did 15-year-old Willie Bass III. He plays Junior.
He's a part of a African-American family. And Junior, he's a little bit on the side of, well, you know, Bobby Kennedy, oh, well, forget Bobby Kennedy, you know? We had a Bobby Kennedy, John F. Kennedy, you know? But in the end of the play, he tends to understand, hey, you know, it's not all about race and it's not all about what you're used to. You get to know who he is and get to love who he is, if that makes any sense. And it all comes together.
Willie was eager to learn more about the Kennedy connection.
One fact that I really liked about Bobby Kennedy was the fact of how you know, he learned how to keep his own ground, even though a lot of people related him to John F. Kennedy, you know, because they were just like, well, here we got Bobby Kennedy, we got John F. Kennedy. What's the difference between them two? Like, you know, they both were handsome. They look alike, you know, but what's the real difference? And, you know, Bobby Kennedy, he really focuses on the fact of how not to judge, you know, to bring everyone together.
And it's a message that is still needed today.
The impact has already started. Now, how far it will go, I do wonder. It is a piece of history that should be examined more closely.
I'll say this much. It's already a success. We have two young people who just said they didn't know much about Bobby Kennedy before reading this play, and already, you know, they are doing what I'm hoping will happen to other young people who will get exposed to it, is that they'll walk away learning more about the Kennedy family, but more important, they'll learn something about their own community. They'll learn that the African-American community was a strong community, and that, yes, Bobby Kennedy's speech was powerful and important that night, but we have some amazing people in this city, and they weren't going to do anything to tarnish the memory of Dr. King or the Kennedys.
I haven't really thought about looking up to a different, you know, race as a mentor, but now I'm really going to question thinking about doing that based off of the fact of this play, you know? It changes different kind of views and opens up different kind of minds.
A woman who works to open people's minds is former First Lady Michelle Obama. She was in Indianapolis recently speaking to a sold-out crowd at Bankers Life Fieldhouse. She talked about women's issues and life in the White House, but much of her conversation reflected that same spirit of the Kennedy speech and how that message is just as important today as it was 50 years ago.
Waking up every day and being a decent person, being kind and open and generous and compassionate, showing empathy for others, just trying to figure out what's happening in the other person's shoes. Assume the best in your neighbors, not the worst. Don't assume that you should be afraid of me, you know? Assume that you have nothing to fear from me because I'm just a person trying to do the same thing. If we give each other the benefit of the doubt every single day, you know, even when you don't agree with them. I mean, Barack says this all the time, and it's hard to do when you're up against people who are just trying to stop you from doing anything. But you still have to kind of figure out why, what's going on in their world, what's their challenge, what are their fears? Because 9 times out of 10, we're trying to do the same thing. I don't care what color skin we are. I don't care what state we live in. I don't care where our parents were born. Most Americans, what I've learned, everybody is waking up every day just trying to get by. They want to go to work. They want to send their kids to college. They don't want crime. They don't want anybody hurt. They just want a fair shake. That's true for everyone. And if we just believe that basic decency in ourselves and we act in that way, that we act on that generosity, you know, in our politics, in our church, in our schools, that's powerful. That is a powerful thing that each and every one of us can do right now today, is to act with decency and with some compassion and being open-minded and open-hearted. And nobody can take that from you if you do that every day.
Keep listening as Curious Mix continues. You ride up and down in an elevator and hear that melodic music, believe it or not, you should give a shout out to one of the greatest jazz guitarists in history, and he was a Hoosier. We are talking about John Leslie Montgomery. He was born in Indianapolis in 1923. He actually got the nickname Wes Montgomery. Now it's starting to ring a bell in your head, isn't it? His brothers gave him that nickname. They were also musicians. Now, Wes had a hard time reading music, so he learned to play by ear, which is remarkable. And he also never used a guitar pick. He just used his thumb. And Wes Montgomery went from playing that beautiful jazz bop music, some of the hard, most influential jazz music of the time with top musicians all over the world. But eventually he crossed over to that pop jazz scene. And believe it or not, that really paved the way for the whole smooth jazz scene that is out there and has launched the careers of many musicians and, of course, filled elevators and office buildings with those soothing yet snappy tunes. An interesting man, a great story, and we're going to talk a little bit more with him as it's time for our Chat with Matt. That means it's time for Matthew Sosi, the host of WFYI's Blues House Party that airs Saturday nights at 8 p.m., to join us here in studio. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Jill.
We are talking about Wes Montgomery a little bit, and it really is remarkable. I think I read he was 20 when he started playing the six-string guitar, which is unusual.
Yep.
And he had that. He didn't use a guitar pick.
No, the thumb, if you've ever played an instrument, a string instrument, if you play it with a pick and you play it with a thumb, it's two different sounds. And Montgomery was such a great player was that it came off effortlessly. It had a smoother tone to it than say, some of the other guys that were using picks. I remember, what was it, James Jamison, the Motown session guy, he only used a finger, one single finger for a bass line. So I think once you get adapted to something, you kind of stick with it. And I think that's what Wes did.
He also created chords that had nobody had ever heard before.
Right.
And you hear all the time now.
Some would say, I'm sure jazz historians, those far smarter than I, that would say the big influence in jazz guitar before him was going all the way back to Django Reinhardt or Charlie Christian. You know, I think everybody who's ever picked up a guitar and has played any jazz in any form, they owe a huge debt to Wes Montgomery.
And he was a family man. He had a lot of kids. He worked a job in a factory here and played music at night.
Right, exactly. So it was he was not one of those that was on the road 300 days a year. In fact, the recording we're talking about, it's his only European tour back in 1965 because he had family, he had responsibilities. And of course, at that time you had the great Indiana Avenue jazz scene where you could see him in one club and then go down the street and there's Slide Hampton and in another street there's J.J. Johnson. You know, it was quite the time.
And as you mentioned, there is the official release of an album, a recording that was made in Paris in 1965 that is out now. And it's pretty spectacular.
It is. It's called Wes Montgomery in Paris. This is from the Residence record label out of California. They've put out, I think, 5 albums of Wes Montgomery recordings. Yes, he's jazz's Tupac. Or Hendrix, is that new recordings, or in this case, live recordings, seem to pop up. They're really nicely done. They sound great. And as mentioned in the liner notes, because this Paris concert is one of the most popular bootlegs in jazz, and Resonant Records makes a point of saying that the family's going to get royalties for this one, unlike you do with bootlegs.
What is it about this performance that made it bootlegged?
Well,
so
it's a really cool performance. He's backed up on this one by Johnny Griffin, Johnny Lovelace, Arthur Harper, Harold Mayburn, which was not a combination he always had. The fact that he was in Paris, and this was a changing time in Montgomery's career because this is 3 months before his release of a really fine album called Smokin' at the Half Note, and then a year later he would win a Grammy for the album Going Out of My Head, and that's when he started doing jazz versions of pop tunes. And some would say he is responsible. You can thank or blame Wes for what is now known as the smooth jazz movement. I tend to think of Wes Montgomery as he's a smooth jazz player, but he did not play smooth jazz. Although I would say the pop covers, that kind of opened the floodgates for a lot of other artists to do jazzy versions of popular songs.
But you're going to get from this release, you're going to get that real Wes.
This is real hard. Yeah, this is real hard post-bop stuff. There's a couple of his originals. He does a version of Round Midnight that clocks in at about 9 minutes. You know, the great thing about jazz is you're public radio listeners. You have long attention spans. Thank you. There's a Dizzy Gillespie tune of Blue and Boogie that he incorporates with West Coast Blues that goes for 13 minutes. This is not him doing the Beatles or Broadway tunes. This is serious, serious jazz on two CDs. It's a must-have from March of 1965.
Sadly, he died in 1968. He was only 45 years
old. Yeah, this is one of the great what could have beens. You know, the question is, would he become George Benson or would he become Grant Green when it came to jazz guitar players? We'll never know. But any time you can pick up a recording of his, now that because he recorded for Verb at this time, he had recorded for Riverside, if I remember correctly. So, yeah, anything, anytime we can get an unreleased recording on Earth. So we have to thank residents for that. This is quite the occasion for music fans.
Wes Montgomery in Paris, the definitive ORTF recording. It's out now. We'll give it a listen. We'll give Blues House Party a listen, too. Thank you, Matthew.
Anytime. Thank you.
Each week, our Curious Mix profiles a DIY, or do-it-yourself, artist in a segment we call Making It. WFYI's Melissa Davis introduces us to a local musician who has found a way to make his passion more than just a pastime.
My name is Grant McClintock, and I create original music. I think music is a natural form of communication, specifically lyrics and rhythm. I have played a lot of instruments in my time, but I started singing when I was a child with choirs and things like that. So that's probably my go-to mode of communication, as well as obviously expressing my creativity with voice.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to miss out. Sometimes I feel I've missed out.
Every piece of art and music is different, so place can motivate you, it can inspire you, it can drag you down if you let it. You can sing the blues, you can rejoice with hallelujahs. Place gives you character, place gives you characters, place lets you remember things, and lets you dream of new things. So it depends where you're at and what you're doing when you want to remember something. I'm definitely big on writing or documenting things because I won't remember it if I don't. I think it's an internal engine that some people, you know, it might run out of fuel earlier than others. Some people maybe find a source of new fuel and they keep going. I took a break from making music for a number of years in the early 2000s. I'm 42 now, so I've pretty much been making my whole life aside from my little sabbatical. And I know that it was definitely a process of inspiration, and I just didn't have it at that time. And it came back to me, and it was almost like version 2.0, where it gave me a new lease on expressing myself. And I learned to do that in new and more exciting and more complex ways, I think.
Grant writes and performs music with the bands Unicorn Derby, Square Social Circle, and Michaelo.
Don't forget to support local art, music, and culture. And WFYI.
That's Making It, reported and produced by Melissa Davis. Just ahead on Curious Mix, we'll hear from a shiro.
I want to showcase, you know, some of these amazing ladies that are recognized, but I don't think to the degree they should be.
and a stargazer.
And because of that, it's easy to miss what's behind it, about 90 light years behind it, to be exact.
I'm Jill Dittmeyer, and you're listening to Curious Mix. Earlier, we learned about a new CD from the late jazz guitarist Wes Montgomery. Now we listen in on a conversation between Kyle Long, host of WFYI's Cultural Manifesto, and another Indianapolis jazz great. But this one is alive and well, and a woman.
You have a lot of projects coming out for 2018, right? I've got a stack of CDs and records and books that you were kind to share with me. And one of the most interesting to me is a project you have. It's a new album titled She Rose.
So She Rose is the second album of my all-female group. The first one is called The Whole World in Her Hands, which is a really long title. So everybody was saying, can you come up with something shorter? And so we wrecked our brain and She Rose just popped up. I thought it was great. And comes out of my advocacy for women in jazz. You know, I've been doing this since a long time, and you realize it's still an upward battle, and that it's for a lot of reasons. You know, initially the environment of performing jazz and where it came out of the Storyville district was just not something where women easily had access to and even should be. It was dangerous. It was a dangerous environment. And so the typical touring bands were guys that could endure those conditions and the vocalists, you know. And then throughout history, you know, it's been difficult. The few that prevailed. And then the way it's taught traditionally, because it was such a mentorship teaching and teaching about improvisation, you know, and still when it's introduced in middle school, that's just not a time when any girl would step out and say, yeah, I'm going to take a risk in front of my peers and make a fool out of me and improvise. That's just not, never would they do it, except the few, you know, that we see prevail. And then just the instrument choice, you know, you play the piano and the flute and you play the trumpet and trombone. So there's a lot of early dividers. So with this project, I want to showcase, you know, some of these amazing ladies that are recognized, but I don't think to the degree they should be. And so we've been touring quite a bit, put four tours together, and this album is coming out, so that's our second one. And we will stage for the first time Jazz Girls Day, two of them actually in Indiana, one in Indianapolis and one in South Bend. And that's a national movement, as if jazz came up with the concept. It's a day of mentorship and clinics and discussions, and the girls going combos and jamming and playing together, and it's an all-female cast of clinicians. So it's a very safe environment. It's, you know, you can put out these factors of peer pressure and all these kinds of things, and very encouraging. And so SF Jazz has been doing it for, I think, 5 years, Jazz at Lincoln Center. And for the first time this year, we have them all over the country, several of them. So,
and Monica, getting back to the CD, tell me about some of the artists you're paying tribute to in the recordings you made on here.
So the concept of that band is our original composition. So most of the others have contributed at least one piece, which the idea is of hearing all these different voices, because I think that's something important too. You know, once we started jazz adapting to more half and half kind of thing, it'll change the language and it'll change how jazz sounds too, and that's okay. And it should be, you know, it should be something that represents everybody. So that's one goal, to hear those compositional voices. And then I have a few pieces that I thought fit in character. We have a version of The House of the Rising Sun. And then Ain't No Mountain High Enough. I just thought that's a really cool anthem. You know, we can climb it. We can do it.
Thanks, Monica. Let's listen to an entire track from the new album, She Rose. Here's Song for CC. Thank you.
That's Song for Cece from the album She Rose. Each week, Kyle explores the history, harmony, and humanity of Indiana music on Cultural Manifesto. You can listen online or at 90.1, Wednesday nights at 8 and Saturday nights at 10. How can a poem inspire a visual artist? Like this. Here's Curious Mix contributor, Terry Border.
Cinnamon Toast by Philip Lee Williams. It's one of my favorite things, Cinnamon Toast. And this poem kind of reads like a commercial for Cinnamon Toast, really. Okay, Cinnamon Toast. Sugared flour, powdered cinnamon, the essential waste delights me. All useless things should be so shot with calories and guilt that's guilt only as drizzles or storms. Spring should slicken and unfold as fast as the sugar melts upon the buds. Forgiveness should be so well formed. That blend delights as gently as gardenias overpower. Beignet, not quite grown, half-baked as a bun, mildly solemn without its milk. Lord, what pointless miseries we dream. The earth is ripe with joy at rain. I want to deserve that gesture in the sweet, twisted, butter-soaked glory of Cinnamon Toast.
What did you want to do after you read this?
Have some Cinnamon Toast. But, you know, the funny thing is we only have like an oat bran bread, and that's just no good for Cinnamon Toast. You need good old Wonder Bread, I think, for a good Cinnamon Toast.
You obviously do a lot of artwork with food. Did this inspire something from that, too?
Well, you know, I have made a lot of characters out of bread and peanut butter bread, and I think Cinnamon Toast is a character that I'm going to have to create. What a sweet, friendly character that would be for a kid's book.
That's Terry Border. He'll be back next week with some more sweet, friendly poetry. We hope you've enjoyed listening to our Curious Mix, but before we leave, a story that requires your eyes more than your ears.
Let's target a nearby star cluster that's easy to find, provided it's dark enough and clear enough. I'm Matt Pelser, and this is your Weekend Sky Report. Spring doesn't exactly provide the most reliable stargazing weather. Rain and moisture from low pressure and fluctuating temperatures can really put a damper on things. But if we get a clear night, sweeping east to west in the night sky this time of year is the Coma star cluster. The Coma star cluster is an open cluster of about 40 stars, the brightest of which form a V-shape that you can see with the naked eye under dark skies. The name comes from the constellation it's found within. Coma Berenices is a small constellation that includes the star cluster, and it's named after Queen Berenice II of Egypt. It's the only modern constellation named after an historic figure, not a mythological one. Now, as far as star clusters go, this one's not that big. 40 stars is nothing compared to some other popular targets. But it is close, around 280 light years away. Other bright stars we can see tonight, like Betelgeuse, Rigel, and Antares, are at least twice as far away. And yes, you need dark skies. In the suburbs, you'll probably need binoculars or a telescope with a wide field of view in order to see the cluster. Far enough outside of town, you'll just need your eyes. And of course, clear skies. To find the Coma star cluster, look to the east around 9:30 and find the bright orange Arcturus. From there, look higher and slightly to the right. Once you see the bluish-white V, you've found it. Binoculars or a telescope will, of course, allow you to see the dimmer stars of the cluster, making it all the more brilliant. I'm Matt Pelser. Happy sky watching.
Curious Mix is made possible in part by the Arts Council of Indianapolis. Brandon Meeks composed our music, and this Curious Mix was created by
Terry Border,
Roxana Caldwell,
Melissa Davis,
Sarah Neil Estes,
Kyle Long,
Matt Pelser,
Matthew Sosi,
and me, Jill Dittmeyer. We'll be back again next week with more Curious Mix.